BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Myths and assumptions about blindness, ancient and modern. That's our topic for today. Tales of our capabilities, or the perceived lack of them, stretch right back to the oral tradition of storytelling through ancient Greek and Roman mythology, persisting right through the ages into our so-called scientific era, but still with plenty of help from pop psychology and overheated imagination. Heartstring tuggers about what we can't do, wild exaggerations about what we can do, most of them completely ignoring the huge variety of causes of losing or not having sight in the first place, and the enormously varied abilities and temperaments of the people who actually live with it. But however irritating we might find these caricatures of our lives, there's also a great deal of fascination to be found in these stories and their effect on the way we're regarded. And our first guest is someone who's turned this ancient fascination into a very modern career move. Natalie Doig is making podcasts about it. Natalie, we'll talk about the podcasts in a moment and one episode in particular, but first of all, just tell us a bit more about yourself and what kind of life and career experience has led you to the podcast business.
For the last 25 years, I've worked in the disability rights field, and I've worked for probably just about every disability charity going and probably just about every sight loss organisation. I turned 50 last year and I knew that I needed to take a step back from the disability rights work. It takes its toll on you. And I wanted to do just something completely different.
So what is it about these stories and assumptions which captures your imagination?
I've come across so many of them, not just personally to me, because I'm partially sighted and always have been, but also to the people I've worked with. I wanted to find a story that didn't fall into those tropes, you know, of the blind person having super hearing or the blind person being blind because it was a punishment. I wanted to find an old folk tale that actually just had a blind person just being a person, being brave, being foolish, or being the centre of the story. And I found one.
So tell me more about this one particular podcast episode about Blind George of Anstey. What was so special about him, or perhaps not special about him?
Yeah, it's a great story. It's about a guy called Blind George. It's set probably 17th, 18th century. He likes a drink in the pub. He plays the fiddle. He's got a dog that he uses to sort of guide himself around. He travels the local neighbourhood and counties performing for money. That's how he makes a living. But it's a kind of devil went down to Georgia, but in this case, the devil went down to Anstey.
Let's give you a little flavour of Blind George as he argued in the pub that you've mentioned with his mates about where a mysterious tunnel actually goes.
Grenald slammed his pot of ale down. It was this nonsense that had interrupted his fiddle playing. You're all a bunch of silly nanny goats. Worse than children. The devil lives below Anstey, does he? Rubbish. That tunnel only goes as far as Anstey Manor. It was used to smuggle beer barrels in or brandy or some such luxury to avoid tax. And how do you know that? Demanded William Jordan. Because nearly every town and village I visit has a similar tunnel story to tell. The devil cannot live beneath every English village or town, now can he?
Oh, I am sorry, Mr. Too Good for Anstey Grenald George. Mr. I've seen the world, except you haven't, have you, Blind George? You haven't even seen the fingers on your own hand, have you?
So, the usual abuse that you can get as a blind person. But in a way, George wasn't special, was he? You know, it turned out he was a bit of a big head. He turned out to be wrong about what lay at the end of the tunnel. He's not a heroic figure, is he?
No, not really. He's just a normal figure. And actually, that's what I really liked. He doesn't use any extra powers because he's blind. The only thing that helps him is the fact that he goes into a dark tunnel and he's blind. And so obviously that's not such a big deal for him. And so the plan was hatched. Grenald would fulfil his bet by navigating the tunnel. He would be at no disadvantage in the dark with Jem, William Jordan insisted. Only Meg warned against the dare. You're pot-valiant and hot-headed, Grenald George. I fear you'll regret this. Don't go down there, please, she pleaded. But Grenald would not listen. And that was how he found himself inching his way along the tunnel, playing his violin so that the pub crew above could follow the sound of the music and find out once and for all where the tunnel led.
You also have this always slightly pervading idea that you might have some kind of special capabilities that they don't know about.
I mean, that one is such a pervasive myth. I came across it about 25 years ago. Somebody who worked for the sort of border force, you know, where they check your baggage and things in and passports in the airports, phoned me up at RNIB and asked if blind people could be trained to sniff out drugs. And I was really shocked. I said to him, do you mean guide dogs could be trained? He goes, no, actual blind people, because you have a better sense of smell.
Well, it's a shame in a way, because it could solve the whole pervasive blind unemployment problem, couldn't it? If it really was true. What kind of response have you had to your podcast?
That episode in particular has had a fantastic response. Later on in the episode, I sit and chat with a friend of mine, Paul, two blind people having a normal chat over a cup of tea, and, you know, they could really relate to it. But also, people have told me it's made them feel less lonely, that listening to my podcast is something that they kind of look forward to. It's like having an extra friend pop round.
Well, let's broaden the debate a bit, because we've also asked to join us from Toronto a couple who've collaborated on a chapter on the cultural history of blindness, amongst a great deal of other work on the subject. Rod Michalko is Doctor of Philosophy and Sociology. He's blind himself. His partner, Tania Tichkowski, is Professor of Disability Studies at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. First of all, I must ask you both, what did you make of Blind George?
I think what I liked about Blind George more than anything, he decided that he would try to both end and start an argument in terms of where the devil was and kind of prove that the devil didn't live in the tunnel, or probably try to prove there was no such thing as a devil at all. And then he meets up with the devil.
Who is there? He asked. There was a slow hiss of air and a laugh.
Hello, Blind George. You're a long way from home. A long way underground, I mean. Are you a mole?
Jen's growl grew more fierce. I ask you again, who are you?
You know who I am, Blind George. I assumed you had come looking for me, sniffing me out, looking for a deal, maybe, a way to improve your rather basic fiddle playing.
Now, Grenald's pride was pricked and his anger flared. He knew he was a good fiddle player, the best in the district. If this was the devil, then he was challenging the wrong man.
Sometimes we blind people have a competition with the devil, and sometimes the devil's name is Norm Al C, something like that. His name is Norm, middle name Al, last name C. You know, and so we sometimes have a battle with normalcy.
I loved the story, and I also loved that blindness did seem to be a bit of his courage to even go into that tunnel, and nobody else wanted to go into the tunnel. I like how blindness could add a little difference to a group of people having a beer.
Why do you feel blindness has particularly lent itself to this kind of myth-making, you know, both positive and negative ones?
Blindness has always had an intrigue for people, including those of us who are blind. It's so difficult, I think, for people who see to imagine, first of all, in the sense of how would I do things? How could I possibly get around? How could I possibly work for a living and all the other kinds of things, to everyday things like how could I possibly cross the street or how could I possibly eat a meal? What on earth do blind people see? The idea of not seeing, the idea of moving in the world without sight. And like any other kind of intrigue, all kinds of stories are going to emerge.
I'd like to bring Tania in on that, because I just wonder how difficult it is to imagine blindness. I mean, your partner is blind, but does that actually make it any easier to envisage what it's like, however well you know someone?
You know, I don't think so. I find myself constantly treating blindness maybe just as like doing things differently, but I forget to actually imagine like blindness is its own way of perceiving. This isn't just about not seeing. This is about perceiving people and events and movement in a different way. And there's something more than just a translation between sight and blindness. It's like a different way of putting the world together.
You're both students of the subject. To what extent has this attracted actual proper statistical analysis? I mean, just to take one example at random, do we actually know what proportion of blind people can play the piano like George Shearing or be a musical prodigy like Stevie Wonder? How much do we really know about blind people's abilities and inabilities as a group?
I think that's one of the modern myths, is that we can know something about blind people to know, as you say, how many are like Stevie or how many blind people can do this or that. I think blindness, like all of life, is much more than a mathematical or statistical issue. More than that, I think it's what Natalie does, something to do with our imaginations, with storytelling, restoring stories. I think we can learn a lot more from Blind George than we can about any statistical analysis.
You're quite critical of things like sight loss simulation, you know, blindfolds or simulating spectacles. Why? Because isn't that at least an attempt to give people an idea of what it's like?
To simulate blindness probably gives the sighted person what version of blindness they already have. So blindness is scary. When you put on the blindfold and you get scared and you don't know how to move, that is the conception of blindness they already have that they're simulating. I'm with Rod on this one, and Natalie, I think, that it's by telling stories of the life and adventure in blindness that you would begin to imagine blindness as something that the sighted person doesn't already assume blindness is. So I think most sighted people grow up believing that sight is wonderful and blindness is scary, difficult, arduous, and means you have to do everything with the help of others. But if you already know that, I don't know what the simulation is going to give you other than those thoughts.
You actually hear people say, now at least I've got an idea of what it's like. But Rod, as two blind people together, it's nothing like that, is it, really?
No, not really, because I could easily take the blindfolds off.
Yes. What should people do if they do want to understand it better?
One thing I think is like try to imagine blindness as something other than the lack of sight. So if you were sitting around talking with a group of blind people or with your blind friends and you wanted to say, well, what is blindness? Just take away the idea that all it is lack of sight. It's got to be something in and of itself, something more than lack of sight. I think that would really change things if we started to talk about, so what is blindness other than lack of sight?
You know, on this subject of understanding, who should be adapting to who? Because it's less fashionable now to look at it the other way round. But you've quoted the American author John Howard Griffin, and he said, sightlessness is an unnatural condition, a minority condition. Thus, it's largely up to the sightless to adjust themselves to the rest of the world and not the contrary. Isn't the real answer to that, that it needs actually to be a bit of both?
Of course, Peter. I mean, it's the interesting notion that the idea of adjustment is in the world for each and every person since forever. We all need to adjust to certain things, whether we can see or not see, or whether we can hear or not, or whether we're men, women, trans, etc. Adjustment is a big part of our lives in one way or another. So when we do have blindness as part of our life, I mean, we need to adjust to it, we need to adjust to others, we need to adjust to other blind people. But to say that sighted people, by virtue of being a majority condition, don't need to adjust is frankly ludicrous. I mean, the sighted people adjust to things all the time.
And so much of the world has adjusted to sight, like the street lights and the pictures and the lighting in the classrooms, like the entire world has adjusted to the idea of sight.
To have some accommodations or stuff made that makes it possible for blind people or others to work in an environment, often it's said it's too expensive to do it. Mm. But the adjustment for sighted people is incredible. It's thousands and thousands of dollars or pounds.
On that, I've always thought that the idea of the social model of disability, that idea that it's society that puts up the barriers and, you know, society needs to make those adjustments, should actually apply to everyone. Like you said, it's not just disabled people. It's not just blind people. Everybody has adjustments made for them for all kinds of reasons. And I think if we looked at it in that way, I think it would make it much easier for everyone to understand.
One last point to Tanya. You've researched the state of blindness in depth. Do you find this ever puts you at odds with Rod in some of the conclusions that you've reached? And if so, what are your points of difference? And how much are those differing conclusions influenced by the fact that Rod's blind and you're not?
That's a great question. And, you know, the snow in Toronto today is making me remember a time where Rod and I were carrying groceries home. I'm sighted, Rod's blind. We're locked arm in arm, carrying a lot of groceries. And at some point, I fall down. I slip on all the snow and ice. At that moment, though, Rod thought he had heard a car earlier, which I hadn't paid attention to. He thought I had been hit by a car. And he's calling out, what's happened? What happened? And I'm thinking, why is Rod angry at me? I just slipped. So we had this like different realities. I'm like thinking Rod is angry at me. Rod's thinking I've been hit by a car. And it took us a little bit to build a common reality up together again. I think that's the case with all conceptions of blindness and sightedness. There's these different realities that get built up over time. We get a chance through blind and sighted conversations to figure out how all people are building realities together. And oftentimes sight gets to be almost like the king, determining what is happening. But, you know, as that little story shows, I wasn't hit by a car, but also Rod wasn't mad. Neither reality really held, and we had to build it up together in our work in theorizing blindness and sighted culture. We try to figure out how those realities get built and maybe where blindness might have a bit more of a say in what counts as real or important or meaningful.
Sighted people, generally speaking, don't think there's anything funny or comic about being blind. It's as if we have a life of sheer tragedy always.
Just finally, back to Natalie. What are your plans for the future for your series?
I try to bring in disability and my vision impairment when I can. For example, I once visited a very scary ruined church, but actually the scariest thing for me travelling there was whether the bus would turn up or not. So I was able to highlight the issues with public transport that visually impaired people face. I think we may come back to visual impairment. I'm going to be working with Paul again, who was in the episode with me. We're going to be looking at haunted railways. Obviously, with us both being visually impaired, that will come into it. But it will be something quite natural. And I think that's the best way to tell the stories, if they just naturally arise.
Natalie Doig, Dr. Rod Michalko, Professor Tanya Tichkowski, thank you all very much indeed. And if you'd like to listen to Natalie's podcast, Weird in the Wade, you can find it on BBC Sounds. Tell us about the misconceptions which most get up your nose, or the ones that you think are the oddest or funniest. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk or leave voice messages on 0161 836 1338. And you can find more information on our website, bbc.co.uk/in touch, from where you can download tonight's and previous editions of the programme. From me, Peter White, and producer